Well, we build this as contrasting views of how and what to engage Iran on, and I think you guys both met the challenge here. What I'd like to do is ask each of you to comment a little bit more specifically on some of the themes that the other one of you raised. Ray, much of your presentation was based on a reading of Iranian politics and understanding of or a greater unanimity among the governing elite about what their objectives are, and therefore you posed certain questions to Americans based on what the Iranians' objectives are in the region, how much can we live with, et cetera. So, Patrick, I'd like you to answer that set of questions that Ray posed. And Ray, much of Patrick's presentation was based on American diplomatic experience and the relationship between the United States and the Europeans, and how we are now in an era where the Europeans actually seem to be more consistent and, one might even say, bullish on some aspects of this issue than we have historically experienced or expected. And therefore, why would we want to undermine that approach? So I'd like to ask you to address that aspect of Patrick's presentation.
I actually don't have a great deal of disagreement with Patrick's idea that we should not exclude and displace the Europeans. I would take issue in a sense that Europeans want ownership of this issue. I think they'll give it to Americans with alacrity that will surprise sprint runners at Olympic level. If the U.S. says, no, we'll take it, they're going to say, no, we want the Iran portfolio. But I think the fundamental issue that Patrick is raising, this is no longer a U.S.-Iranian dispute. It's articulated in the context of U.N. Security Council. It is a series of U.N. resolution. This is no longer a bilateral dispute. It's an international dispute. And I don't think you can exclude the Europeans from any sort of discussions. As a matter of fact, I think it is helpful to have the Europeans and, to extent possible, the Chinese, the Russians, Japanese, certainly, in these negotiations in order to present Iranians the picture of international unanimity, given the fact that historically their diplomacy had tried to divide the United States from its allies. So in that sense, in terms of modalities of the negotiations, I don't particularly have any dispute. In terms of the diplomatic history of failed negotiations, I think if previous failure tends to deter one from future action, that's not exactly a model of American success that I can think of. And with Bazargan and Brzezinski having those negotiations, the context of Iran politics was different. The context of the region was different. Today, for better or for worse, there is a consensus within Iran that they're willing to have negotiations with the United States on the broad spectrum of issues. That is not some facts that was sent to State Department or whatever it happened or didn't happen. It was an official document given to Mr. Solano by Ali Larijani on behalf of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So it was an official document whose credibility, authenticity, was not challenged by anyone and certainly enjoys the approbation of all the power centers, including the Supreme Court. I think Patrick is absolutely right about the suspicion and paranoid style of Iranian politics and their suspicions of the United States. But, you know, the United States has engaged and negotiated with other countries who were equally suspicious of its motives, the Chinese, the Russians, the Soviets, the Vietnamese, and so forth. So given the fact that there's a history of antagonism, emotionalism, suspicion between the two parties should not necessarily deter one, it certainly, I think, makes negotiations between these two adversarial countries much more difficult. And I end with the point of agreement with Patrick in suggesting that our expectations should be modest. The point about it is, can one arrive at some sort of accommodation with the Islamic Republic of Iran? It seems to me that's not an unreasonable proposition to test. Are the Iranians paranoid? Well, you know, up to mid-1970s, the Soviets used to insist in negotiations with them that the United States recognize the boundaries of Eastern Europe. Now, who in their right mind thought in 1973 the United States was about to adjust the boundaries of Eastern Europe? No one. All regimes born out of a revolution take with them a certain degree of suspicion and paranoia, and that has to be taken into consideration. The negotiations where the United States offers to authenticate the legitimacy of the Iranian revolution in exchange for the Helsinki process, you know, it's no skin off back to say, yeah, you had a revolution and we recognize it. We have said so in many other occasions. So repetition of that is not necessarily something that is going to retard our moral standing. But, you know, as I said, to have negotiations between these two countries that yield some sort of a result, we have to arrive at our own perceptions about what type of Islamic Republic we want to live with, what type of Iranian regional influence we want to accord, what type of Iranian nuclear installation we want to accede to, how much Iranian influence in the region are we willing to accept. And at the end of the day, maybe we arrive at the judgment that actually what Iranians want in terms of regional influence, nuclear infrastructure, presence in the Gulf is something that is unacceptable to us. We may arrive at that judgment. We may arrive at that judgment through negotiations, suggesting that, you know, at the end of the day, the price of engagement and the price of normalization is not, we're not willing to pay. And that's a perfectly acceptable proposition. But at this point, I would go back and say we haven't actually tested that.
I would, Rob, I generally agree with Ray's description of the consensus, that there is a consensus among the Iranian elite, governing elite, and that consensus is that Iran is indeed the natural great power of the region, to which the other countries should give great weight in making decisions. And that the fundamental problem that we face is that the other countries around Iran do not agree. And those countries are our allies and close friends, most of them. Some of them rather surprising ones, like Pakistan. But they are allies and close friends. And they do not agree with that proposition. And they do not want to see Iran have the influence that Iran wants. And that Iran thinks the way it's going to gain that influence is in no small part through force, through subversion, as in Lebanon, through, by an Iranian accounts, being the principal founder of an organization determined to overthrow, to wipe out a UN member state. I mean, it's the Iranians who say that they're the principal funders of Hamas. I think they're right.
So long as Iran is, in fact, determined to have an influence which its neighbors do not want to see Iran have, and that Iran is determined to gain that influence through subversion and force, I think it's fair to describe Iran as not being a status quo power. And that's a basic problem. And until Iran makes the fundamental decision that it will pursue its campaign for influence through a different means, the prospects of a grand geostrategic bargain with Iran are slight, very slight. We may be able to reach agreement about some specific issues. There are some particular matters and where we can agree about how we will disagree. For instance, I think of the tangle of our mutual disputes against one another in all kinds of different international courts and domestic courts we ought to settle. And we may also reach agreement on some particular specific matters where we have a common interest, such as a way to avoid incidents at sea between our two neighbors. But a fundamental geostrategic bargain ain't going to happen. Because Iran, so long as Iran remains a power determined to acquire greater influence in its region through the use of force and violence. I would make it clear that I think it's perfectly okay if Iran wishes to pursue greater influence in its region through peaceful means. That's fine. But that's not the campaign that they're on. We recently had our Spring Sword Symposium. We had a speaker from Kuwait who reminded people of the long history of the Iranian actions in Kuwait. I mean, we tend to think just about U.S.-Iranian relations. Look, I mean, in the mid-1980s, the Iranians were responsible for blowing up the U.S. and French embassies in Kuwait. The Iranians repeatedly attacked Kuwaiti tankers. The Iranians launched missiles that landed on Kuwaiti territories. The Iranians say, we haven't done aggression against any of our neighbors in 300 years. Talk to your neighbors. Talk to the ruler of Sharjah about what happened to his islands. Right. Talk to the Kuwaitis about what happened to their oil tankers and those missiles that landed in their territory. Their neighbors do not agree with them on this. And that's the fundamental problem. Not what we are prepared to accept. The fundamental problem is what are Iran's neighbors prepared to accept. And so long as they find Iran's demands unacceptable, and Iran insists on pursuing them through force, that's where we got a problem.
Let's open the floor to your comments and questions, and if you could
be so kind as to speak into the microphones if they're lit on the table in front of you and to identify yourself, then I would appreciate it. On the back, Dave Pollack.
Your microphone?
Yeah, thanks very much. Very interesting. Ray, you said several times that if and when we do engage Iran, we need to decide for ourselves what kind of Iranian behavior we can accept on the nuclear issue, on issue of support for terrorism, and many other things. But you never answered that question. So I want to ask you to come to grips with that really crucial question. And for Patrick, if I may, you talked about, yes, the Europeans have stuck with their position much longer than anyone would have expected, and we should support them in that, and I agree. But to what effect is the question? What effect has any of this had on actual Iranian behavior on the nuclear issue? And if it hasn't had much of an effect, then perhaps you would say that containment, real containment, hasn't really been tried yet, and that we need to toughen our approach on sanctions and other issues. Do you want to please address that question? Thank you.
Sure. Let me just one thing on the European unity. Patrick, you got to start talking some Germans. It's a little less robust. On the issue of nuclear, what I would hope to end up at the end of the negotiations is an Iranian nuclear program of some uranium enrichment capability. And the physics of this largely leads me, but building in a surge caution within it, whereby if they want to go from 3% to 90% uranium enrichment, you have sufficient notification period so you can build technology into it to retard it. I would actually try to impose a set of intrusive verification procedures, 24 hours, on-site inspections, surprise notices, where you can have some confidence that the program is not being diverted for military purposes. On the issue of Iran's influence in the Gulf and the region, I mean, I think I agree with Patrick that neighbors are uneasy about Iran's ambitions, but they're not necessarily going to do much about it other than balancing their relationship between the United States and Iran. They're in a very difficult position. But overall, you would have to accede to some Iranian influence in the Gulf, and certainly in Iraq, where Iranian influence is significant and growing, and one would hope to channel that influence in more constructive directions, such as pressing the Shi'i groups into further accommodation of some Sunni demands in order to creation of some unitary government, as opposed to accelerating the pathway to the civil war. On the issue of the Arab East, the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, the Lebanese, I think the Iranian-Saudi mediation of Lebanese civil war is helpful. I'm not quite sure we should always object to Iranian diplomacy because it leads to growth of their influence. The two parties that are against Iranian-Saudi mediation of Lebanese conflict, the United States and Syria, for very different reasons. As I mentioned, it is inconceivable to me that Iran can maintain its military relationship with Hezbollah and have a different type of relationship with the United States. Iran can have a relationship with Hezbollah, but one would hope that it would press Hezbollah away from a direction of paramilitary group whose purpose is pressuring Israel to a political party representing certain segment of the Shi'i community. Those are the endpoints that I would want to end up with. If through the process of negotiations that I end up there, then there's no process that's worthy of validation through diplomatic relations. And of course, I mentioned human rights. Now, that might be too much to traffic bears. You know, as I said, I'm not quite sure if this will succeed. I'm not making any guarantees that the regulation of Iranian influence will necessarily come about through the process of engagement. But I think it's something perhaps that is worthy to try. And also, it gives Iran a certain degree of interest in having a relationship with the United States that it has not had before in terms of its integration in the global economy, recognition of some of its regional priorities, acceptance of some of its regional influence, having them have some sort of a nuclear program, which we have said we would help in terms of the civilian nuclear program. So perhaps those set of relationships with the United States will temper their more revisionist impulses toward other set of issues.
To what effect the European stance? Well, the Iranians have had their nuclear program now for 19 years. They haven't gotten very far. I mean, they're worse than me in cleaning up my house. I mean, 19 years, what do they got? Not very much. And that's in no small part because of our successful efforts to make sure that they don't get their hands on technologies. I mean, it is impressive that with all those IEA inspectors running around Iran, they didn't find evidence of Russian involvement in the enrichment program. All our concern about the information that was going to leak out from the Bushehr power plant into the enrichment program, our concern about Russian scientists, we don't find that. It's in part because we made a big deal about it. And this Iranian program is going at a dramatically slower speed than the Iranians are claiming it is. Believe me, go ask the Israelis. And that's been an accomplishment. Now, how are we going to know we're coming to success? Well, there's a wonderful description of the Iranian negotiating process by one of their previous chief negotiators in these matters, who said that Iran's style is to negotiate to the last to the 90th minute and then get half as much as they could have at the 59th minute. And that's true. Whether it's on the Iran-Iraq war or whether it's in business negotiations, the Iranian approach is to say no, 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 oh, yes. This is not a country with which we narrow down the differences over slow negotiations that you get closer and closer until finally you dot that last I and cross the last T. It's not been the experience in any negotiations with the Iranians on any matter. And it would be very surprising if that were the situation here. When's that moment going to come? I don't know. I mean, I'm the first to acknowledge that $75 a barrel oil and you get nuclear program is our inalienable right, $25 a barrel oil and you get dialogue of civilizations. It would be a lot easier to solve this problem if, in fact, the price of oil were a lot lower. I was once optimistic that would happen sooner rather than later. Now I suspect it'll happen later rather than sooner because of the pace of world economic growth. But I still think that there's a good chance that we can persuade the Iranians, governing elite, that this program is just way too expensive. The Iranian governing elite does not seem to regard this program as essential for the country's national defense. They regard it as primarily an expression of Iran's great civilizational progress, as a prestige item, and as a way to influence its neighbors and to gain greater power in the region. Well, that suggests to me that they might be prepared to give it up. If people saw this as essential for their national defense, they're not going to give it up. You are not going to get Pakistan or Israel to give up their nuclear weapons. Ain't going to happen, folks. That's not the situation that Iran faces. And that's one reason why I think at the end of the day, there is a good prospect that that the Iranians will change their position sharply and dramatically one day.
Why don't we take a series of questions or comments? Barbara Slavin, Paul Richter, and Steve Rosen. No, not Steve Rosen. Alan Griffin.
Okay. Thank you both. Really good and interesting presentations. Patrick, just a point of a factual point. There were actually rather productive negotiations that Ryan Crocker led that were one-on-one, no chaperones in the room. From 2001, November 2001 through 2003, early 2003, they were taken over by Khalilzad. But actually, they agreed on a lot, and they got a lot. So, you know, I don't completely agree with your point about how it's always fruitless. I think the question is, Bush administration has a limited amount of time. Given everything that's happened, given the enormous strategic advantages that Iran has reaped because of the overthrow of the Taliban, overthrow of Saddam, chaos in Lebanon and the Palestinian territories, given the distrust that has been built up with Bush because of Axis of Evil and a lot of regime change rhetoric from administration officials, is there really any prospect of sensible and useful negotiations between the two sides, even on Iraq? I mean, the Iranians sense we're withdrawing. They've agreed to these talks. And neither of you mentioned the military option. Is it off the table as far as you're concerned completely? We're beginning to hear bubbling up again people like Joe Lieberman and Norman Podhoretz and others talking about bomb, bomb, bomb Iran. Off the table, what would it do? Thanks.
Paul? Into the mic, please.
Paul Richter with LA Times. Patrick, I wonder if you could tell us how you think administration policymakers are looking now at these talks with Iran, how Ryan Crocker and all the rest, given that they only have 18 months, is this mostly about showing American flexibility to the Iraqis, to the Europeans, and our Arab allies? What's it all about? What kind of payoff do you think they can get in the brief period they have?
Alan?
I'm unclear on the position of the panelists with regard to regime change. Is it your position that any talk of regime change, any hint of regime change by the United States is definitely a non-starter for any possible enhancement of relations? Or do you believe that in certain circumstances the regime change can be a bargaining chip? For example, you mentioned, Patrick, the MEK, that they are, Iranians are afraid of their own shadow. Well, certainly easy things that the United States can do to curb the MEK. Is that a bargaining chip for the United States?
Actually, on the last point, if I could pose that question in a somewhat different fashion. If indeed it's true that the Iranians are scared of 75 million, which has never really been spent or dispersed in the manner in which it was, if the Iranians are really scared of 75 million, shouldn't we spend several magnitude of that? And that would drive them into doing all sorts of other things?
Let me just touch on the first question about what would the – can the Bush administration negotiate successfully with Iran? I suspect the answer to that is no. I think there's a level of mistrust and suspicion toward this particular American administration within Iran that militates against successful negotiations. I think there will be direct or bilateral or multilateral negotiations between United States and Iran in whatever modality, but they're likely to be more symbolic than substantive, as was the Crocker-Qoumi meetings in Baghdad. I mean, this is a very paranoid government, and for them to go to comprehend the trajectory of American rhetoric from we're not going to talk to them in order to legitimize them to 28 years of mistakes. For them to understand these positions, you have to go to a decompression chamber. I don't understand it, and I live here. So that's sort of a remarkable transformation from one extreme to the other. I think they view it as some sort of a trick. And frankly, their position is not that dissimilar to Patrick's position. This is not a two-track policy. It's a one-track policy, and the rice rhetoric is aimed at the Europeans, aimed at to get the Europeans to solidify against us. So they don't even accept the offer of appeasement, because they think there's something inauthentic and suspicious about it. If I can go through the rest of the question, is the idea of a change of regime a bargaining position? I mean, we have said, and to Secretary Rice said in the Financial Times interview, that that's not our policy, it's regime behavior. Now, if Iranians paid attention to John Bolton, they have reason for their suspicion, because he said our policy is not regime change, and since leaving office, he said, yes, 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 it is. So that authenticates their suspicion and their perception of American mendacity. So John Bolton was probably not a good example of how to understand a coherent American policy. But, you know, we've already taken it off the table, repeatedly. So to use a Bush administration phrase, we are where we are. And that's no longer, if it is in fact a lever and a bargaining chip, we have already relinquished it prior to going to Sharm. Secretary Rice explicitly took it off the table. If $75 million misuse and misspend is not doing a trick, should we spend $75 billion misuse and misspend? I think was Rob's question. It's not a question of money. It's the question of the fact that we don't, the money is being spent in a number of ways. It's broadcasts. Most of it goes to broadcasts, which I think is rather innocuous. Then there's assistance for civil society groups in Iran. And let's be frank about it. We have don't have access to civil society groups in Iran. They don't want that sort of an association with us. This is not Eastern Europe. It's a different sort of a regime. It's a different sort of character. It has a different sort of opposition. I'm not quite sure if, given our paucity of knowledge of that country, our lack of relationship with its key political actors, we can actually engineer a change of regime through financial assistance to NGO groups or what have you. On the issue of whether or not this regime should change, I think we're in agreement. Now, this is a reprehensible regime. This is a reprehensible regime. It's reprehensible toward the citizens. It's reprehensible toward its neighbors. It's reprehensible toward everybody. You know, so there is no disagreement among anybody here, I suspect, about the character of this regime. And the principal victims of it have been the Iranian people. You look at where Iran was in 1978 and where relative to some of its neighbors, Kuwait, and where they are today and where Iran is today. This is, everybody would be better off without this regime, but it's in existence. And I'm not quite sure it can be easily displaced. And ignoring it doesn't lessen the dangers that it poses to its neighbors and to its citizenry.
What can the Bush administration do? Well, they're kind of busy. And I think they'd be quite delighted at the idea that this is somebody else's job. You know, for a long time, the successive French governments perfected the fine art of sitting on the sidelines and criticizing that they could have done a better job if they were in charge. We accuse them of being irresponsible. And I think we're finding the position rather comfortable now. Bombing Iran. That's silly. At a time when the U.S. intelligence community says that this is not an urgent matter, when the U.S. State Department says our diplomacy is going from success to success, and our military says we're kind of stretched right now. Hey. On the other hand, the diplomacy is more likely to be successful if we can persuade the Iranians that, in fact, there is a vigorous military effort that's going to be made to make sure that a better-armed Iran cannot coerce its neighbors, and that a deterrent capabilities can be important in dissuading, as the Soviet Union discovered with its SS-20s. So I do think there's a lot of merit in reassuring countries around Iran that the United States is going to stand with them, and that they don't have to cut some kind of deal with the Iranians. And it would be very useful if the European allies were to follow through on the fine commitments they make for the defense of the Gulf. I mean, it's nice that the French signed a treaty of mutual defense with Qatar, interesting idea of Qatar defending France. But I would be even nicer if they would do something about it. On the question of the talks with Iran, I suspect there are a lot of people in the administration who don't anticipate we're going to get very much out of this, but who would say that this is very important in order to demonstrate that we are going to make that effort. On the other hand, it is conceivable we'll get certain things out of it. I mean, for instance, I think it would be very useful to have relationships at a working level so we can approach the Iranians and say, could you please give us a map of where you think the border goes in the sea? I mean, it would be nice to have one. And it would be nice to be able to have some kind of way of you know, exchanging information and things like that. And on, I can imagine all kinds of issues that arise because of our large-scale military presence about border where exactly the border goes, all kinds of things. So we might get something out of it, but I think that the main thing we get out is exactly what you said, is showing the world, including the Iranians, the Europeans, the Americans, that we are prepared to be flexible and talk to the Iranians about as much as we can. Regime change. As Ray said, it's not a bargaining chip because the Iranians won't believe us if we take it off the table. They just don't believe us. They just don't believe us. They do not believe us because their concept of what constitutes regime change is George Soros. George Bush cannot persuade George Soros to tell George Soros what to do. There is no frigging way that George Soros is going to answer a telephone call from George Bush and say, oh, well, gee, thank you. Now that you explained that to me, Mr. President, I won't do it. Ain't going to happen. And if they think that the Open Society Institute is an instrumentality of the United States government, the degree of paranoia is really impressive. And furthermore, Rob, we probably won't get very much for spending a whole lot more. I mean, I would be in favor of spending somewhat more. I'd certainly be in favor of spending it better. I mean, I urge you to read Mehdi's study about the U.S. broadcasting to Iran. It's embarrassing how badly it's being done. I was a great fan of that broadcasting until Mehdi did his study and pointed out to us the kinds of things that they do. It's a very nice study. It just shows it's basically unprofessional.
Not the study, the broadcast.
The broadcast. The broadcasting is unprofessional. And I think that there are a number of areas where we could be spending some more money on cultural exchanges. We've had some successes on educational exchanges. I certainly think we should be spending more money on processing visas so that it's easy for Iranians to have their visas processed. I mean, that study forcing hard choices on Iran, we give some horror stories about these matters. But basically, we're spending 1,000 times as much money is not necessarily going to produce a heck of a whole lot more than we can now.
Reminder, this is a G-rated presentation. Dana Marshall in the back, Mr. Amite and Ms. Foyer on the center, and on the right in the back here, and on the left over here. If you can go to a mic, please, on the table.
A couple of questions. Probably these are for Pat. Pat, I was comforted to some extent, but I wonder if you might be able to add to my comfort when you made a very good, simple, declaratory sentence that the elites are not behind this. I wonder if you could elaborate a little bit. What evidence do we have on that? What evidence do we have that they have much bearing on the views of the people that really are calling the shots? I mean, after all, as you pointed out, this has been going on for 20 years through a number of different supreme leaders, presidents, and presumably elites, and it continues to go on. The fact that they haven't gotten very far, I don't know. I mean, when you're dealing with an IAEA that did not know that Natanz was there, and you're dealing with a government that didn't know that they didn't have WM, I mean, it's hard to have a lot of comfort on that. That was one question. The other one was on the Europeans. You mentioned a number of times this may be an area where the Europeans might best lead. I wonder if you look at the performance with in the immediate period after the capture of the Brits and how little they would have had to do to support Britain, and there was complete silence and sort of looking at shoes at that point. What evidence do you – how much comfort do you have that they really will do something and can lead in any way other than just a charade way? I mean, really lead to something that I think we could all agree might be effective.
Mark?
Yeah. Since I didn't hear either speaker address this, may I assume that you both discount the role of religious ideology at all in Iranian conduct, and the mullahs don't mean what they say. Ahmadinejad, when he talks about the 12th Imam, this has no bearing at all on their behavior?
Deborah. Right in front of you.
I'm not sure. My question may have been implied in the question before Maury's. What I was going to ask is, Dennis Ross made a really compelling case the other day for applying all the tools of statehood in addressing the Iranian nuclear threat, most notably the tightening the economic noose where Iran is so vulnerable. Patrick, you alluded specifically to European bullishness on stopping Iran's program. So my question to you is, how do you think that bullishness could be mobilized to get them to move on the economic front?
Yes, I'm Joe Macaron from the Kuwait News Agency. I just want to comment first on the precondition for stability. the precondition for containment. I mean, maybe it's a little late to contain Iran at this stage. And the problem is how to contain Iran and the U.S. foreign policy has conflicting interests at the same time in the region. And it's also impossible to contain Iran with why the U.S. has physical presence in the heart of the Middle East. And so my question is, because Mr. Klopsen said how much influence can be taken from Iran. So the question is, I want to ask, is how much desperate the U.S. needs to engage Iran in order to succeed in Iraq, and how much desperate it needs Iran to contain the to keep the status quo in the Middle East as it is now.
Does Iran have the upper hand because of our vulnerability in Iraq? Yes.
Hi. I'm Aaron Faust from the House Committee on Foreign Affairs. Would either of you, I guess, especially Patrick, since you just addressed this, be in favor of opening up a visa office in Tehran so that we could deal maybe better with some of the visa issues that we've had, like last summer with a bunch of academics not being allowed in for a reunion, and to increase, I guess, contact with the Iranian people?
Right.
Let me just say about VOA. As a consumer of it, I think they do some good things. I mean, I watch the program News and Views on 3:30 every day, and you know, to improve my comprehension. And you know, it's not bad. But nevertheless, its professionalism is perhaps below par. Religious ideology, I think, was a question as aspect of Iran. Iran is a peculiar revolutionary state in a sense that it hasn't totally abandoned its Islamist pretensions. I mean, the Soviet Union, the Chinese, eventually the communism was not an animating force. So in that sense, religion is still a pillar of the state in a larger metrics, along with national interests, strategic objectives, and those religious pretensions all battle each other to produce a foreign policy that is often incoherent and often contradictory. So I wouldn't necessarily exclude the type of rhetoric that comes from Iran as unnecessary and to be dismissed. I do think, having said that, I don't believe that Iran's nuclear program is designed for eradication of Israel, and I do understand why Israelis are legitimately very concerned about it, this view that I just offered is not one that is accepted, much less embraced in Israel. They have to take the rhetoric seriously. I think the issue of, just going from my memory, the issue of visa office, I don't think the Iranians will accept an American visa office. I think we have considered that sort of a council. I mean, the American Iranians who are abducted and held today are not offered consular services today. So, I mean, ostensibly we have a representation there, the Swiss, that can go and make routine visits. The utility of economic sanctions, if I'm just my memory, does Henry Kissinger used to say every second-rate power has a breaking point? He never found Vietnam's. They found his. Does Iran have a breaking point? Yes. I mean, this is not the country that is 10 feet tall. And there's, if a serious multilateral sanctions regime is enacted by hopefully through the United Nations, adhere to for prolonged, at least considerable period of time, I think that will make an impression on the ruling elite regarding the policy objectives. But that's sort of a significant economic sanctions program. It's hard for me to see how it can come about in the era of global economy and global financing and so forth. So Iran may experience economic pain as a result of what is happening, and it's undeniable that the country is experiencing economic pain about what is taking place. The question is the regime willing to tolerate that threshold of pain in order to achieve its core security objectives, and perceiving now that it has, to go back to the question that was made, leverage over United States and international community in Iraq, and even the nuclear issue. And when Laura Johnny says, our nuclear advancement changes the content of the negotiations, which in essence he's suggesting that as Iran's nuclear program accelerates, the international community will have to adjust its terms of reference to Iran and to that program. So in that sense, they view the development of a nuclear program as a means of negating international pressure. I think they're quite wrong about that, but that's just where they're at.
Thank you.
Patrick, you have the last word.
Great. The role of religious ideology. Look, the ideology that Ahmadinejad trots out is not based on the great sacred texts of Shia Islam. He makes it up on the fly. It's much more based on a folk religion. I mean, I know we don't like analogies, but it is much more like Hitler that way. Hitler made it all up. And that's what this guy's doing. We got a nice study by Mehdi under our way, pointing out how this got nothing to do with the Shia thought. And therefore, in some ways, it's more dangerous, because basically it's political ideas dressed up in certain religious frills. The elite's attitude towards the nuclear program, the broad consensus that, you know, a nuke's a good thing to have. But at what price? And I just don't think I don't think there are many people in Iran who think that Iran has to have a nuke in order to preserve the regime and to preserve the country. It's much more a question of this would be a nice thing to have. That's a very different attitude than saying this is essential for our very survival as a people. And because of that, I think we have an opening to persuade them. Where are the Europeans really going to go on this? Well, as Ray said in the side, the Germans are soft and squishy. I mean, one prominent German once put it to me, we're Liechtenstein, but on a slightly larger scale. And however, the dynamics of European politics are that the Germans are not going to break solidarity with the French in this one. Just aren't. And the French are hard as nails in this. I mean, they were tough enough under the previous president, but they're tougher under the current one. And this, look, I mean, if you know much about French society, it's basically run by the anarchs, right? The people from the École Normale d'Administration. And they understand nuclear issues, because that's one of the few things that France has had which makes them into a great power. And that's one of the reasons why France was not prepared to sell the Shah enrichment technology. None of the Western powers, in the end of the day, were ready to sell the Shah this technology. You think we're going to let the Islamic Republic have this when we wouldn't let the Shah have it? At a time we were all enthusiastic about nuclear power? Ain't going to happen. I do think at the end of the day we'll have to have some compromise where the Iranians will get to keep centrifuges so long as they don't work. And fortunately, centrifuges being very complicated and technical devices, there are lots of ways to have centrifuges that don't work. So we will agree to a face-saving solution in which Iran will get to keep lots of centrifuges that don't work. Does Iran have the upper hand? Is the United States desperate to have Iranian help? The problem is that the Iranians, Revolutionary Guards in particular, are convinced that they do have the upper hand, and the United States is desperate. And that's our big problem. And frankly, that's why I think that pressing Iran economically is very useful, great, but it's more important we figure out a way to change the Revolutionary Guards' perception. They have to feel the heat. Now, perhaps we can do that economically. The Revolutionary Guards care a lot about their personal income. That's why they shut down the new Tehran airport for 2 years until they could make sure they could continue to smuggle through it. Perhaps we can do it economically. I suspect we're also going to have to do some deterrent measures, arresting some guys in Erbil. But we've got a big problem, which is that so long as the situation in Lebanon is read by the revolution and Palestine is read by the Revolutionary Guards as suggesting that the United States and its allies are useless, Security Council resolutions about ban on arms shipments are ridiculous, we got a real problem. Revolutionary Guards read the geostrategic situation as saying that the West, especially the United States, is helpless. And that is our biggest single problem at the moment. On the question of a visa office, I would rather be in the kind of position that the Europeans are in, which is to say, have at least an intersection, if not an embassy. I think we have to persuade Iranians, and more importantly, we have to persuade Americans and people around the world that we are not the problem, but the problem is the Iranians. So Ray is quite right. The Iranians aren't going to accept this. But we ought to be out there all constantly offering it, so that there is this constant impression in people's minds that the United States is eager to have more contact with the Iranian people
and it's the Iranian government that shuts it down. I mean, the Iranian government's done us a big favor by arresting all these Iranian Americans, because it has driven home the point that who's the fundamental barrier here? I mean, look, the Iranian government won't give me a visa. They won't give Gary Sick a visa to go to Iran. Right? And any of you know Mr. Sick has been somebody who's devoted much of his time and effort over the last 25 years to improving U.S.-Iranian relations. And they want him in. We got to get that point across to everybody. The fundamental problem here is the Iranians. And I think to do that, we should be constantly talking about how eager we are to have an interest section, to have a visa section, to have consular officers, to have cultural affairs officers, and constantly badgering them with how much we want to do on all of these fronts.
Well, Patrick, Ray, thank you very much for offering this set of contrasting views on how to approach the question of engaging Iran. Thank you all very much for joining us today.